KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, the Egyptian surgeon turned political satirist Bassem Youssef is with us. We'll get his thoughts on this week's Oval Office visit of Egypt's President al-Sisi, whose crackdown on dissent prompted Youssef to leave the country, where he was well known for speaking out against the regime on his popular new satire show. We'll also hear what it's like to go from having 40 million viewers in Egypt to trying to make it in America. Join us after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Egypt's Bassem Youssef went from being a heart surgeon to a comedian during the Arab Spring to having a warrant out for his arrest. His political news satire show, Al Bernameg, spoke out against the Egyptian government and at its peak had nearly a third of the country tuning in, earning him the title of John Stewart of the Arab world. But as the revolution that brought hope of freedom gave way to another dictatorship, Youssef fled with his family. These days, he's traveling the U.S. with a new multimedia show and working on several other projects. He'll also be at the San Jose Improv this weekend. But for the next hour, he's with us, and it's great to have you here.
So nice to be here. Hello, San Francisco. Hello, San... I don't know. Good morning, Vietnam. I don't know how you start this, but...
or Bay Area.
Okay.
So you left Egypt at the end of 2014, but you first went to Dubai. So how long were you there and how long have you been in the U.S.?
Well, I fled Egypt November 2014. I spent like around a year in Dubai, and then I came to the United States.
And then how much time did you have to make the decision to leave Egypt before boarding that plane to Dubai?
4 hours.
You had 4 hours.
Yes.
And it began with your lawyer telling you you should leave.
Oh, yes, because we woke up on the news that I lost a case against the network that actually canceled me after one show criticizing the new government in Egypt led by Sisi. And so we went for a month like debating this in the courts. And then he told me this is a political verdict because there was no way that I would lose because I was the one who was canceled. And they said, like, you have to leave because they're coming at you for you. And this is like a way in the Middle East, basically they get you through proxies. They would never go and take you out from... They do that now. But at the time, it has to be something about taxes or financials or a legal dispute. So they will have the... you know, the excuse to take you and put you away.
Well, you had angered the government of Mohamed Morsi, the government that took power before al-Sisi and took power after the Arab Spring, and they did issue a warrant for your arrest, but you managed to fight that and you did not leave and you continued with your show, Al Bernameg, the show, mm-hmm. as it's titled. Then al-Sisi comes to power and that is no joke. You decide that under al-Sisi, you definitely need to leave. What was the difference between these two leaders?
Well, I did fight under al-Sisi for a whole season. People tend to forget this. I was canceled after one show in the network, so I went to another network.
That's right.
They couldn't bear the pressure. So after 14 weeks, they said, Bassem, we're sorry, but the pressure is too much. We have to let you go. And then I stayed for a few months. But the difference between the two is that one of them tried to stop me but couldn't, and one of them tried to stop me and they succeeded because they won by experience. Because the military regimes in the Arab world are there for the past 50 or 60 years. So, first of all, they are revered and feared by the public much more.
Yes.
And when you live in the Arab world, especially in Egypt, you discover that the army is more sacred than religion. And he had everything. He had like the power, the police, the courts, everything. So you can't have a wiggle room. So I decided to leave.
And so, as president, remind us how al-Sisi has cracked down even more on political dissent in ways that people are describing as being almost unseen in Egypt.
Oh, what are you talking about? We are the most democratic countries in the world, or at least that they will tell us. I mean, we have to believe the media, right? So, yeah,
their media, you mean?
It's of course. It's it gotten quite bad. I have friends who have been, who are in jail, and who've been in jail, and now they're out on probation, and it seems that there's no stopping of it. I mean, as long as he continue to have the support of the regional powers and America looking the other way, he would continue to do that.
Looking the other way to things like jailing journalists, civilians, torture,
yeah,
disappearances even.
It seems that most Western powers don't mind as long as they continue selling weapons to us. So as long as the weapon sales continue to soar, that's fine. And I remember like one Western diplomat from a Western European country, I told him, like, why do you still support this system and other systems? He's like, well, if we don't, he's just going to go get his weapons from Russia and China. I was like, oh, that is a very compelling argument.
Well, what do you then make of al-Sisi's visit to the U.S. this week, to the fact that President Trump told him that he's doing an outstanding job? And
how many times did Trump say about someone that he's doing an outstanding job? We can count the times. And he usually uses that to describe people who are not doing a great job. But again, for Trump, it doesn't matter as long as he continues selling weapons and as long as these little dictatorships give them what he wants. See, whatever security arrangement that he needs, whatever weapon sales that he wants. So it's just going to continue happening. And the difference between Trump and Obama is not that great, by the way. It's just like with a liberal left-wing government, there's like an occasional slap on the hand, but the weapons never stop. Maybe they will stop the weapons and the aid for a while, but then they will continue.
Yes, President Obama did keep al-Sisi at a distance, I guess is the best way to describe it.
Yeah,
Trump is having meetings with him in his Oval Office, not bringing up humanitarian, human rights violations and things like that. But help us understand the other side of this, though, why al-Sisi needs President Trump's embrace in some ways. Because he is trying to get a constitutional amendment through that would give him basically presidential powers.
In that area of the world, there is an understanding or maybe a belief that you need to get the blessing of America because it is the big superpower and this is where you get your aid. So basically you go there, you get the blessing, you show the pictures to the media, say like I have the support of the strongest man of the world and now I can go ahead with whatever changes I want to do with the Constitution. And it's not just Sisi, it's like everybody in this part of the world, whether it is a rich oil country or it was like a republic that is ruled by the military, they need that blessing. They need that photo op. This photo at the White House, like, hey, I'm
legitimate.
I'm legitimate. I've kissed the ring, and I come back and I do whatever I want.
Well, one of the things that really prompted you to launch your show, The Show, besides the fact that you've been watching Jon Stewart host The Daily Show and really inspired by what he was doing in The Power of Satire, was that you had reached an endpoint with all of this. Though, I mean, I listen to you now, and you kind of have this almost a sense of resignation to how things are and how the governments work over there. But you were really compelled to put yourself at risk and launch this show that was going to try to reveal the lies, the fake respect that was being given to this regime. So first, can you talk about what made your frustration boil over to such an extent that you were ready to challenge?
This was a general mood in the region. When you had the Arab Spring, there was like a feeling of hope. There was finally a feeling that we can actually make a change, so that our voice matters, that our what we do matters, that this is our country, not their country anymore. And this period of hope lasted about three and a half years. But at a certain point, you are crushed by not just like a military regime, but basically the rest of the world being silent. And you can't continue putting yourself into harm's way because other people stayed and they went to jail. And now you need to be smart about it. So you say that I have a sense of resignation. That's not true, because there are other ways to fight other than going there, putting a show on YouTube or on television, and then get jailed. Because what's the use if you can't be free and speak about it? But there's another way to do that. And that's why I do this show. I go around the country and I tour around the United States and even Europe to tell my story in a funny way. It's hilarious. The show is hilarious, by the way, guys. I mean, don't be fooled by how serious this conversation is. But like, when you tell your story more and more around the country, people now understand what's happening in the region. People understand what happens in Egypt. And it's a long game. So maybe at a certain point, there will be enough people that can influence the administration to tell them this is not the way that we should deal with politics in the Middle East. So right now, people don't care. I mean, right now, people are more concerned about the premiere of Game of Thrones and whatever and the playoffs more than a regional president in the Middle East coming to visit Trump. But maybe when you go around the country and you tell the story and you tell them how it really is, more people would be interested to say, like, you know what, this is not where we should put our tax money. So it is more of a long game. It's not a resignation. It is just like a change of game tactics.
I see. So then, you know, stand-up and doing this particular show is very different from doing satire. Can you?
It is still satire, but
yeah,
like,
okay.
I do it in a, and it's not like a straight stand up show. It's not like a man with a mic show.
Yes.
I show stuff from the Middle East. I show snippets of my journey here as an immigrant, because that's important too. I'm now a resident of this country, and a lot of things happened in the last 2-3 years, and it affected me as someone who just moved from the Middle East to the United States. So I want to talk about that too, because that is also an important conversation to have in these days.
Yes, very much so. And I want to get to that a little bit. But going back to just this question of the role of satire, one of the things I saw the documentary about your life, Tickling Giants,
yes.
Or at least about this period in your life when you made the transition from heart surgeon to comedian and satirist. And one of the things that was clear was the power of satire in mm-hmm. terms of really kind of cutting through all the noise and showing what you felt really needed to be communicated to people. But it was also incredibly polarizing, where mm-hmm. you ended up having huge protests against you. I think at one point you describe half the 40 million or so viewers that you had at one point.
Yeah,
they hate watched me. Yeah, they hate watched you.
I'd like to thank them for pumping up my rating.
So what role do you think satire plays? And do you think that it draws people together or drives them apart?
Nothing will draw people together, because people always have different opinions. But here's the biggest benefit of satire is that it brings people to the table to discuss matters that might otherwise be dull or difficult to understand. So, for example, when Jon Stewart was talking about the VA affairs is like something that's very dull. But when he brought people together to discuss what's at hand, the conditions changed. When we were discussing bills that were passed by the parliament, we were discussing things that were very dull to consume. But we brought people together to discuss this. The other important role of satire is that it takes away that halo of fear away from dictators and rulers or leaders. When you can laugh at something, you cannot be afraid of it anymore. And that's very important, because most rulers, most authoritarian leaders, they use fear and they hate satire. Because if you laugh at me, I cannot scare you. And this is why satirist comedians and cartoonists are the first targets of any authoritarian regime. A lot of people don't know this, but when Hitler came to power, satirists and comedians were one of his first targets. And even when something like Charlie Hebdo you know, satire and cartoons were something that is so offensive that they have to eliminate them. There was also a very famous Jordanian cartoonist who were killed in Jordan because he dared and made some what they called an offensive cartoon. So satire is a way that, like, you sit back, you tell whoever in power, I'm not afraid of you, and I'm going to make fun of you. And that really pisses them off.
We're talking with Bassem Youssef, political satirist, author of Revolution for Dummies, Laughing Through the Arab Spring, former host of Al Barnameg, a satirical news program in Egypt. And he's headlining the San Jose Improv this evening through Sunday. And tickets are still available for his show at improv.com/San Jose.
And a Nobel Prize winner.
Someday. And so, Bassem Youssef, who do you think is doing satire well in the U.S. related to our own government?
Oh, everybody. I mean, like, I love Trevor Noah. I mean, he really filled the seat after Jon Stewart. Stephen Colbert is just fantastic. John Oliver, of course, with his, like, very deep investigative reporting. It just, like, when we watch, this is the thing that even SNL, when they sometimes they, like, I mean, not all of the episodes are great, but, like, I mean, they do an amazing job satirizing what's happening in this week's news. And this is the wonderful thing about satire in the United States, is that you whenever you find it, it's still alive. It doesn't matter who's in power. The one thing, of course, that kind of upset me is that, you know, everybody is saying, like, we don't like Trump because of that. We don't like Trump because of this. And, of course, I had my problems with Trump as a president. But the one thing that he did that really upset me, that's like, oh, my God, that's that you shouldn't do this, you know. When he, for the second year in a row, he boycotted, maybe now the third year, he boycotted the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
Oh, the Washington Correspondents' Dinner.
Yes.
Journalists, yes.
Yeah, because even Bush didn't do that. Even Reagan. Reagan didn't go to only one, and he was shot at the time. And he called
in. So he had a good excuse.
And he called in from the hospital. This is how important this dinner is, because this, even if it was a facade, even if it was like a make-believe, but this is a symbol to say that, you know what, I am the strongest person in the world. I am the president of the United States, but I will come to this dinner so you can make fun of me openly. I can make fun of you. It's fine. It's okay. Because, and I maybe a lot of Americans don't realize this, but like this event is anticipated by the whole world. And the very famous Stephen Colbert Bush night is still being played, and it's translated in Arabic, and it still generates millions of views on YouTube.
So
this is important. And so when you say, I'm not going to come to this dinner, it's a statement saying that, like, I'm not a public servant. I am above satire, and I'm above ridicule, and I'm not going to subject myself into this. And that is a very negative message.
And someone who communicates that, do you find that dangerous? What does that mean to you when someone says, I am above this?
Yeah, well, it means that he doesn't see that as part of his job to be ridiculed and criticized. And we have seen how badly he takes criticism. I mean, say whatever you want about Obama, right? But maybe he complained a couple of times about Fox News, but he wasn't calling them fake news every time. He wasn't calling them the enemies of the people. You know, it is, and that's a very dangerous route to go down to. He went to all of the 8 correspondent dinner, and people were making fun of him, and it was fine.
What do you think of Fox News? I mean, given that the media in Egypt is what really upset you, too, the frustration of how you saw it as an arm of the regime, do you feel like, I mean, Fox has been accused of the same thing. There's a documented very close relationship between, you know, people on their programming and the president himself. Or do you think that's just all overblown?
I'm conflicting about Fox News. On one side, I don't like their message, and on the other side, if they go away, there will be absolutely no material for late night shows. But the big difference between Fox News and the state run media in Egypt is that the media in Egypt is state run. Yeah, this is like privately owned. So okay, but I think they're the way that they. They spread. It is very disturbing that the president of the United States gets his news from this one channel. And I cannot forget the one time where Fox and Friends, which is of course the most intelligent show on television, they were having like a camera on the White House, and they were asking the president to flicker the lights of his room if he's watching, and he did, which is like, what?
I must have missed that episode.
Or maybe it's fake news. I don't know. There you live. We live in a world. But like I've seen the video. I don't know if it's made up. But and the fact he calls in and whatever is said on Fox News, he repeats it in his press conference. That's very dangerous.
Well, what people have warned who are concerned about moving towards more of an authoritarian style government or the chipping away at democracy is that it's a slow process. There are small changes that then build up to where you find yourself in a situation where the U.S. is primed for an autocrat, for example. Do you think that you see signs of that happening based on your own experience under authoritarian regimes?
Well, there's two things. One, yes, there is this disturbing sign, and anybody, especially someone like Trump, he doesn't like to be held accountable. So yes, if it's up to him, he will turn this into an autocrat. But there's a lot of differences here in the United States. First of all, there's a lot of power in the hands of individual states. You know, there's the local governments have a sort of autonomy and power that doesn't allow this to happen. So that's a good thing. And the other thing is, like, every 2 years you do have a chance to change things around, whether on the level of local congresses or like on the level of the midterms. And every 4 years you can change the president. Yes, there is everlasting effects of damage, especially on something like education and healthcare and environment, you know.
Yes.
But again, it is. I think
you sound hopeful, I have to say.
I do, because like, first of all, that's like my last place. Like, I mean, that's like my last hope. I don't know where to go after that. You know, like I
you
just
mean if you can't make
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I mean, I left the Middle East and I come here and you turn into
another. Everybody's looking at Canada.
I mean, am I
right
jinxing
now?
Everybody? And like, now I'm afraid to go to Canada, and then Trudeau will be replaced by I don't know.
You think it's you? You think you've come to a country?
Yeah,
and
I think it's me. Now I'm worried and.
Well, let's hear what our listeners think. Do you blame Bassem Youssef or do you celebrate Bassem Youssef for bringing Trump to power? He's the Egyptian heart surgeon turned satirist. He's moved to the U.S. After his show was canceled, Al-Banameg, that had...
Twice.
Whoa. More than almost a third of the country.
I was
canceled twice.
Yes.
More than a third of the country, or nearly a third of the country of Egypt, tuning in. If you have questions for him, give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, on Facebook, Twitter, or email us at forum@kqed.org. More with Bassem Youssef after the break. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're joined by Bassem Youssef, whose show Al-Banameg had almost a third of Egypt watching before he was forced off air by the Egyptian military government that came to power in 2013. Known as the John Stewart of the Arab world, Youssef gained international fame for his willingness to test the boundaries of speech in an authoritarian country. His books include Revolution for Dummies, which chronicles the Arab Spring in Egypt. He also has a one-man show. He is headlining at the San Jose Improv tonight through Sunday, and tickets are available at improv.com/San Jose. And I'd like to invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. If you have questions or comments for Bassem Youssef, the number 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Our email address, forum@kqed.org. Our website address, kqed.org/forum. And of course, we're on Facebook and Twitter. And we asked our listeners what role satire has in today's political climate. And we have a question about satire. I'm going to start with Frank in Sacramento. Hi, Frank.
Actually, halfway between Sacramento and San Francisco.
Yeah, so you're in your car.
I'm driving away from federal court where our trial just ended. But anyway, I accept your premise that the rulers should be not shouldn't impose any limits, right? It's kind of like it goes with the territory. But the question the other way around is, do you as a satirist impose limits on yourself? And I'm thinking about both the Dutch cartoonist who was killed for putting out cartoons that offended Islamists, and the same problem with Charlie Hebdo. Is do you think that there's a point where you say, look, I'm not going to attack somebody's religion, or I'm not going to. I mean, how would you define those limits if you agree that they should exist?
Limits. Are there limits that you would even impose on yourself?
Well, I think everybody poses his own limits. I think there should be no limits, and I think when I draw limits, I draw it personally. But I think that there should be nobody ever be incriminated or harmed or killed because they would post a cartoon or say a joke about, even if on somebody else's faith or religion. Because I had this debate with people from my part of the world. It's like, but those people, they draw the Prophet Muhammad. It's like, all right, so if you go kill them, that you have solved the problem. The internet will not going to be raging with even more cartoons and more insults. This is the world that we live in. You should accept other people's opinions, even if that offends you, because if you eliminate them, that does not solve the problem. I have a certain line of satire. I like political satire. I don't go into other people's faith, but that's my prerogative. That's my choice. But I would support anybody who say whatever they want. So, for example, there's a very huge, successful Broadway show called The Book of Mormon, which I have enjoyed. And I think there should be no problem having the same thing about other people's religion or faith or beliefs, because you can't use violence to eliminate other people's point of view or opinions.
Well, what do you think about, there isn't so much violence or jailing or even killing, but there's huge, say, social media backlash and death threats against comedians if they, I don't know, I'm thinking of Kathy Griffin and, you know, the image that she apologized for of holding, you know, Trump's head, basically. And then, you know, you have even at the press correspondents' dinner where you had, you know, backlash as well for insults.
Kathy Griffin thing, I was personally insulted because, like, a woman like holding like a decapitated head, that's our thing in the Middle East. You should not, that is cultural appropriation. You should not use, we are the only ones who are.
Telling a joke. Just in case anybody did not catch that.
I know it took a while, but the thing is,
you just delivered so deadpan initially that I was a little worried that it might not be coming through.
The thing is, you cannot control social media. People will be outraged and will. But I of course, I'm not a big fan of death threats. I get a lot of that myself, but you know, as long as it stays on Twitter, you can't control it. But you cannot control social media, right? What if you said a joke and like 90% of the people didn't like it, and does that mean that you can't tell it?
Are there no lines? I mean,
there shouldn't be. All right. Let's say, for example,
gender.
Let's say, for example, there are lines. Who draws them? Who puts them? Who is in charge to say? Who's going to be the police? Who said, all right, this is the kind of joke that you can say, this is the kind of joke who cannot tell. I mean, whenever you put lines and limits, you have to ask the second question, who puts the lines and limits?
Well, I know some comedians do have structures where they, or lines or guidelines where they say, I'm going to punch up, meaning I'm going to punch against the people who are in power as opposed to people who are marginalized,
yes,
or oppressed.
That
is a line.
That is a personal choice. But again, you cannot really put limits for everybody, because now you're becoming your own authoritarian people, and you're telling people what they say and whatever. I mean, I would rather, as you said, I would rather to make fun of the people who are in power other than people who do not have power, because there's no courage in making fun of minorities. You can a little bit, but I mean, it's, again, it's a personal taste. I think the quality of your satire or comedy is it's elevated by how high up you punch up the comedy, not low down with the people who are underprivileged.
Well, Shukran writes, I'm a huge fan of yours and have so much respect for your humor and using it to stand up for the Egyptian people, who are some of the warmest, kindest people in the world. I'm glad you were able to leave safely. My question is, don't you ache for your homeland?
I do, of course, but like, what can you do? I mean, there's two things that I do miss. The beaches, because there are beautiful beaches in Cairo, and I miss that in LA, because you just sit on the beach, you cannot go down in the freezing ocean. And the second thing, I miss mango, because whatever you have, you guys have here, it is not mango. You have been fooled, you have been lied to. Whatever you have here, it is cucumber disguised as mangoes. You do not have mangoes, and we do need to bring Egyptian mangoes here, and now I will not miss my homeland anymore.
So you have not been back at all?
No, since November 2014, I've been here.
Your father passed away while you've been here.
Yeah.
You did not go back.
I couldn't go back to bury him, and that was a very, a very sad moment in my life that I couldn't go back. And I talked to my brother at the time. He said, "Like, listen, you never know what will happen. You can go in, but they will not let you out. We never know." And
did you do anything here to mark it for yourself from a distance?
When my dad died?
Yes.
What can you do? I mean, this is something that is, I'm not about like a big show, but when it comes to these things, you know, I just had to, you know, remember the times that we had. I mean, both of my dad and my mom, they died within maybe a year and a half. And I know that it sounds a little bit strange and weird, but I also look at that as a blessing, not a curse, because at least I had my grandfathers and my grandmothers, I've seen them die a very slow death. You know, the people when you have like die of old age and disease and decapitated.
Yes.
But they died in their prime. So they didn't have to suffer. And I look at that as a blessing. Not many people can say that. My dad died in an accident, and my mom died in her sleep. And as
a car accident.
Yes. And as devastating this is, and as sudden and as horrible as it is, but maybe if I had the choice, I wouldn't have had them have a very long death, where I couldn't go back and take care of them, and I would have felt very bad for that. But I'm happy that they died in their prime, in the peak health. My dad was playing tennis until the last week of his death. My mom was like planting a beautiful tree in her backyard until the last week of her death. So I try to remain positive and look at it in a way that is not selfish, because I wouldn't like to them hanging out on a string in a very bad health condition just because I want them in this earth.
Well, let's go to more calls, and we'll go to Ellie in Walnut Creek. Hi, Ellie.
I love Walnut Hi. Creek.
Good. I wanted to ask your host if he has any views on Iran, and if he follows the political satire in that country and what he thinks of it.
Well, if you come to my show, I will make a joke about Iran just for you. I have not met a single Iranian that was not very cultured, very educated. Lovely people in Iran. Of course, there are some exceptions in Beverly Hills. They're very rich Iranians that defy that rule. But no, seriously, one of my favorite comedians is Mas Jobrani. He's like, I'm a big fan of his. He's been on my podcast. Mm-hmm. He's like a lovely person. And I do follow what happened in Iran. And the theocratical government there is very strong. But maybe there is hope, because there's like a lot of young Iranians who don't follow that. The religious doctrine doesn't really go deep within the young people, and there's even like an Iranian satirist who's also called the John Stewart of Iran. It seems like we have John Stewart of everything. We have to have like you need to sell that product.
Well,
yes.
Speaking of optimism, I'm curious if you're optimistic about the movements in Sudan and Algeria. I mean, you've had Bashir now forced out of power in a military coup. You have Bouteflika resigning last week after massive protests that began with a bread strike in rural regions, so it was hard to contain. You have the people speaking and wanting to take their countries back, but you also have experience with this through the Arab Spring. Are you watching these, and what are you watching for to see if the outcome will be different, where it won't become a dictatorship again?
Yeah, well, the operative word here is the military. Yeah, it is.
Yes, military.
Yeah, because basically they removed the president, who was the head of the military, and then the military took over. And that's exactly what we had in Egypt.
Yes.
And the question is, will the military willingly give up power? And here's the problem with the military giving up power. When you give up power to become a democratic country, the biggest, the most important pillar of democracy is accountability and transparency. And when that happens, all of these military are corrupt. All of these military take commissions on buying weapons from the West. All of these people have invested interests in that country. The question is not just them giving up power. Will they be willing to be exposed and be investigated? That's the biggest thing. And I don't know what will happen. It is funny now because there are people, there is on social media that they said that there's a circulating chant in Sudan saying like, it's like Nasr or Masr, which basically either victory or the Egyptian fate, which is, are we being an example of failure now? That's horrible. And everybody now is afraid of the Egyptian scenario or the Syrian scenario, where people go out and they have a brief time or where they think that they won, and then the military takes over. Because in you have to understand, in this part of the world, the military is not just in power. They're in all levels of authority. They're in ministries. They're in local governments. And this is why it's very hard to get rid of these people.
Well, Ben writes, what does your guest think about the idea that only a strong leader to the point of a dictator can manage to keep down Islamic fundamentalism in that part of the world? Wasn't al-Sisi elected as a backlash against the Muslim Brotherhood? I mean, Ben has a point. One of the ways that dictators were able to keep power was in part because of the rise of ISIS and them using that to say, see, you need my protection. You need a strong person here.
Yeah, but for example, in Egypt, for example, people were radicalized in the prisons of the military dictators. The militaries need the radical Islamists because they need that as a scarecrow to tell the West, like, it's either me or them. And most of the ISIS leaders in Syria and Iraq were basically bred in the prisons of Bashar Assad. And you think that that people think that there's a duality. It's either those people or the secular military dictators. Those military dictators are not secular at all. Al-Bashir in Sudan has actually formed some sort of alliance between the Muslim Brotherhood and the military. So it is not really, it's either or. Both of them will even get together and they will form an alliance against the liberals. You have to ask your question, do you want an authoritarian leadership or a liberal leadership, which basically it's always been crushed by both of the military and the
religious. So do you have less hope for what happens in Sudan, even though it did begin in, you know,
I'm not going to say anything to
nation, and it's very much based on domestic issues.
I still want to be hopeful. I hope that the Sudanese youth will actually overcome this. But I'm watching carefully, in the words of UN officials.
Well, Todd writes, satire is the only thing that can overcome fear-based voting for Trump. Colbert Pelosi 2020. That's Todd's ticket there. Mark asks, satire tends to exaggerate reality in order to make a point. What is a satirist or cartoonist to do when political reality and absurdity outpaces satire?
That is a very good question, because sometimes when you have people in real life, they really outdo. A lot of people say, "Oh, Trump is giving you a lot of material. Sisi or Morsi giving a lot of." No, you actually have to work harder. That's why, for example, some of the Saturday Night Live sketches is reenactment of reality. They don't do it. They don't do much.
Well, Juan says political satire here has been ruined by Trump. Some great comedians got Trump derangement syndrome and turned Trump jokes into the new airplane jokes, overused by everyone.
Yes, that's a big problem. I mean, if someone dominates the news, what else can he do? You know? So, but I can tell you that my shows are not just Trump-centric. I have a couple of jokes about Trump, but the rest of the show is fantastic.
Well, you have also tried to do stand-up here. You said this is a little bit different than just straight stand-up.
Yes.
Talk about, and I've always felt this way about anyone who tries to come to the U.S. to do comedy. It's such a hard thing. And, you know, this came into stark relief for me as a kid, you know, watching a comedy with my mom and cracking up at things and her just having absolutely no idea what the movie was about or what was funny, because there just isn't that cultural foundation to really understand the jokes. And so how has it been to do stand-up here as someone who's really just been here since 2015?
Hard. Because here's the thing. Whatever happens in Egypt doesn't really count, because I was doing comedy in Arabic. Now I have to do it in my second language, in English. And it's not just the language. It's language references. That's one thing. It's culture. That's the third thing. But here's the thing. You can have the perfect joke, but you have to think about the delivery, the pacing, the speed, about everything. And when I was starting, I was having a real time, because, like, why aren't people laughing? And it was not just a joke. It's like there's so many things other than that. And I had to rewire my brain to understand how I get into this space. And it was not easy. You have to practice a lot. You have to practice with in rooms where there's people who don't know who you are. It's like when people ask me, how do you want me to present you? Just say Bassem from Egypt. Don't say all the thing about, like, the John C. Now, don't raise their expectations. Just, like, put me out there, and I have to win over the audience that who doesn't know me. And it was a process. And the process is still there. You know, I can say that I have cracked the process. And it's been exciting, interesting, and terrifying sometimes. But yes, it's I had to develop a certain technique, to change the technique. I have to accommodate to the room. And it's hard.
So you were a household name in Egypt.
Yes.
What's it like to basically, to some degree, and I hope this doesn't come off as disrespectful, but you're hustling for gigs, and you're trying to make it here in the U.S.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm 45 years old, and I'm doing stuff that a 21 years old who just came from the Midwest trying to make it in Hollywood. Yes, there's no shame in this. So there's no disrespect at all. But it is hard, and I think now I'm going to be writing my second book about this. But you know what? If I make it and I become successful and I'll be on the podium winning my Emmys or the Oscars, I'm going to be speaking about that. And people will stand up, giving me a great standing ovation. And
But it sounds like you've made peace with the fact that you may not reach the heights of fame that you did in Egypt.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
And you almost, it's almost, at least in reading and seeing your documentary, it was incredibly difficult for you. The level of celebrity combined with the authoritarian regime kind of, you know, boring down on you and all of that. There was so much stress in terms of expectations and also in terms of the hatred and the violence that was being threatened against you.
My life has been a series of events where I would give up something that I have been working for all of my life and starting anew. So, for example, for 18 years, I have studied and I worked as a heart surgeon. And I left that for the uncertainty of entertainment and comedy. And then I reached the peak of stardom in the Middle East, and I came here and I started from all over again. So I think, as much as terrifying and scary it is, but isn't it amazing that you get the chance to start your life all over again and again and again and
well,
again.
Well, that's the American dream, essentially, one that many feel is.
But
is
that's
away.
I think it's also human nature. I mean, I think this is the it's much better than having a stagnant life, and it's great to try to find new venues. And when I'm like 80 years old and I'm drunk in an Irish bar, I will have amazing stories to tell.
It's all about stories. Robert writes, does Bassem Youssef think Americans take their liberties and democratic system for granted, liberties that may be lost without increased civic engagement?
Well, no, because you seem to be quite angry of what's happening. So, no. And as a matter of fact, I get asked this question in reverse. A lot of people say, do you think that we're like babies because we complain too much? And I said, like, no, you should be. You should be complaining and kicking and screaming because you have earned this kind of service. And I always give that example of like somebody going into a 5-star hotel and he's complaining about the service and the food. It's like you telling him you should be grateful because there are other people who can't find food in Africa. It's like, I don't care about what's happening in Africa. I have earned this kind of service, so I'm not going to be reduced to whatever service being delivered somewhere else in the world, you know. And I think you should be kicking and screaming and asking for more and not to be satisfied.
James in San Jose, join us.
Hi there, Bassem. I've got two questions. First, have you ever thought about running for office in Egypt? Why or why not? And number two, in your view, why did Mohamed Morsi was not able to rise to the occasion when he was elected president of Egypt?
Great question. So, yes, should I be running to office? No. All of the people who ran to office in Egypt ended up being killed or detained or assassinated. So, no. The second question is, the reason Mohamed Morsi didn't run, he comes from, it's not about Mohamed Morsi, it's about his clan. His clan, the Muslim Brotherhood, have a certain idea of what religion should be and that they should have some sort of a country that should be having some sort of a religious tinge to it. And he was following the orders of his clan. And I think that will be the problem of all authoritarian leaders in the region, whether they are religious or military, until they find out that the only way forward is a complete secular country with a complete separation of state and mosque, because, you know, not church. But and this is the one thing that these people didn't realize. Sisi is putting the military first. Morsi put religion first. And that is not the way for a modern democratic country nowadays.
Well, thanks for the question, James. Mike writes, I'm among those who believe Mr. Youssef is in the vanguard with a chance of saving the world. My question is, which are the countries, cities, or communities in the Muslim world which have the best chance of bridging the wide divide between the Saudi Arabias of the world and the West?
Saudi Arabias of the world. All right. That's pretty much of a blanket statement. But I look at the Tunisian experiment,
mm-hmm.
which gives me hope.
Yes.
And the reason why Tunisia...
It is the exception of the Arab Spring.
This is why they were the exception. Yes, for decades they were under authoritarian leaders. But two things. Number one, they understand what secularism is. They don't consider it as a stigma. Many people in the Arab world, they consider being secular is anonymous of being atheist, right? And the second thing is, the military was not a big player in politics. It was the police, but not the military. The military has always been separate, which is, I think these two things made Tunisia stand out from the rest of the Arab world.
Well, let me see if I can squeeze in this call from Jamal in San Francisco. Jamal.
Hi, Bassem.
Hi.
I'm from Sudan, and I've been your show all these years when you used to do it from Egypt. My question to you is, why can't you have a show on YouTube? That's where, you know, the whole world will see whatever you have to say. And then no one would stop you.
Jamal, thanks.
Thank you, Jamal. So first of all, Jamal, I'm waiting for you to come to the show tonight or tomorrow or after tomorrow, or I'm going to hold you. I'm not going to answer this question. No, I'm going to answer this question. So the thing is, as I told you earlier in the interview, there is different ways of resisting. If I did the YouTube show, I will still be talking to the people inside the country. I want my message to be now more global. And I do that through these live shows. And I think there is a time and a place for everything. People think are still stuck in the 2011-2012 mentality, where they think like a couple of videos of YouTube can change the world.
Do you get people who still come to you and say, oh, yeah, I feel like you turned your back on us, that you left us, that you abandoned
yes,
us?
Yes, yes. But like I don't think that it is right to sit in the comfort of my residence in the United States and to do things, to tell people to do things in the Arab world while you are safe.
So in our
and plus, I still do have family there, so I'm not completely safe.
So in our last iteration, in our last few moments, what is this last iteration or this most recent iteration of Bassem Youssef? How would you characterize yourself at this stage in life?
This is a rebirth for the third time. I mean, you know, like Protestants are like, you know, they're born again. I'm born for the third time now at the age of 45. And I'm trying to find a new form of expression in a new country, for a new audience, in a new language. So come to my show, people.
Well, Mary writes, "Oh, Bassem Youssef, I love Tickling Giants and I am enjoying everything you're saying this morning. If my husband and I didn't have the cold from hell, we would find the way to San Jose to see you in person.
Come
Thank
and wear
you
a
for
mask.
All you do. Thank you for all you do. I second that. Thanks, Mary. Thank you for all you do, Bassem Youssef. And thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Bassem Youssef, political satirist, comedian, multimedia show tonight in San Jose. Check it
Nobel
out if
Prize
you can.
Winner.
I'm Mina Kim. You're listening to Forum. Another hour is next. Bye.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis. On view through April 14th, Blue and Yellow Corridor, an iconic work by Bruce Nauman, realized on the very grounds where the artist conceived it.